So, but what would you say was the political lesson from last week, from Perek, Shmuel Bet Perek Bet Pasuk? I'm sorry, Shmuel Bet Perek Aleph. Talking about political lessons in Shmuel Bet. So, for one, do not appear opportunistic. David is about to become king of Israel over the death of the previous king. Right? Remember we said last week, the king is dead, long live the king. David cannot appear to be happy with that. And we're not saying that he's masking his emotions. He is really not happy. The death of his father-in-law, the death of the king of Israel, the death of his best friend, Jonathan. And he kills the young lad for appearing to brag about killing the king and thinking that the king would be happy with this information. He has in his possession something of great value. A crown and king's bracelets probably have value. Right? He's not going to do something stupid. He thinks that giving this material to the king is worth more for me. He'll give me more than this value. He could take it himself and pawn it someplace. Right? So he feels that the death of Shaul will be taken as better news by David than by the Philistines. Let him go to the Philistine king and say, look what I have, the crown of your enemy. What will you give me for it? I mean, you know, I guess, what bargaining position is he in any situation? They just don't go to David and sell the crown to someone. So that's the way David must make it appear, as he does in chapter 3 with the death of Avner, and chapter 4 with the death of Ish-bosheth. Right? In all cases, the news should really be good for David. Another person who's standing in my way of being the undisputed king of all of Israel is out of the picture. And yet, in each case, he reacts violently to the person who thinks that he will be happy with this news. Right? The only one that he doesn't kill from these three is Yoav, for killing Avner, either because David needs Yoav, he's my own chief of staff, or two, more likely, it was his sister's son. So when David probably made some kind of move to kill Yoav, his sister begged him not to, and it's obviously something that doesn't appear in the Tanakh.
And Yoav has a real reason to take vengeance.
Oh yes, Yoav doesn't like Avner himself. We'll see that coming up also very soon. Okay, so let's just review last week. Question?
I had a question about last week, actually.
Yes.
It's a question, it's really, it might sound challenging, but it's really a question of understanding on that part, which is like, that it seems like the all these people that killed other people, that was wrong, and that's why David had them killed, but why is it okay for David to have those people killed?
Now, if you, let's go with all three cases. In the case of Rechav and Ba'ano, that's not a difficult question. These are two people who killed a king, an innocent king. There's no country on planet Earth that would not kill those people for doing so. The only thing that they thought, that Ishbosheth, who was the king of 11 tribes, is standing in your way, David, of being the king of everybody. So they thought that this would curry favor with David. So let's put that out of the picture. Yoav killed Avner. David would have been in his rights to kill Yoav for doing that. David had just signed a peace pact with Avner. Someone on my side now killed him without coming to me first. Actually, Yoav did come to David first and says, what are you making a peace pact with Avner for? He's your enemy. So David says, I'm in charge here. I'll decide who's my friend and who's my enemy. Right?
He also killed his brother.
And yeah, well, Yoav has lots of reasons to want Avner out of the picture, that's for sure. But David, simply for Yoav's act of killing Avner, was in his rights to kill Yoav for that. The most difficult one is, why did he kill the lad? That's what last week's
share.
The lad. Who said he killed Shaul. I mean, I asked you this question last week. What was he to do? To say to him, die. You die in your own. Let the Philistines kill. You know, he said, kill, finish me off so that the Philistines don't capture me alive. Mm-hmm. And we know what the Philistines did with their captives, right? And especially, we talked about suicide last week, remember? So the only thing I can say is that David killed him not because of the facts of the story, but because David perceived that the boy was lying.
He was an Amaleki,
that you find in the Radak. Rashi, remember I mentioned last week, the first Rashi in the Sefer says it was Doeg HaDomi, but then he disagrees with it. He thought enough of it to cite it. Rashi doesn't cite every Medrash in the world that he disagrees with. So I would like to just review the reasons why David thinks he's lying. And I actually have what I believe is good proof of it.
There is evidence. He was lying.
There is evidence that David thinks he's lying. There's evidence to the reader, right? Mm-hmm. There are a few things. The boy is trying to sound very convincing. For one, when he first introduces himself to David, and David says, "Who are you?" He says, "I'm an Amaleki." The second time, after he says, "I killed Shaul," and he says, "Who are you?" Again, he asks him. He goes, this time he says, "I'm a Ger Amaleki." I don't know whether that's true or not. The Ger Amaleki means my father converted from Amalek. There's a dispute whether an Amaleki can actually halachically do so. Just because the kid said so doesn't mean that's halacha. But Rashi, in a few places, says that an Amaleki may indeed join the Kehillah, convert, marry Jew, and can be considered Jewish. Only Amon and Moab can't, but Amaleki can. So that's a dispute in Mankli Meforshim. There's a Machilta that says that Amaleki cannot convert, cannot even convert. Amonite and a Moabite may convert and be counted in a minyan and be a Rosh Yeshiva. They just can't marry Jewish woman. Well, Yavobi Kal Hashem means they can't marry. Be that as it may, the fact that he changes first Amaleki to Ger Amaleki means that he feels himself to be in a little trouble. Don't kill me because I'm Amaleki. I'm not an Amaleki anymore. I'm a Ger Amaleki. Two, remember this is only open for the reader, that Shaul in the story fell on his sword, and the boy said that he fell on his spear. There's a big difference between the two. Right?
Right.
Another thing, the text keeps calling the boy Hanar Hamagidlo. Hamagidlo. Three times it says Hamagidlo. So in chapter 4, when Rechav and Ba'ana brag to David and they say, "Here is the head of the son of your enemy. Now you're the undisputed king," thinking he's going to make us prime minister now, right? We're important chashuv men, right? So David says, "When the Magid just came to tell me about the death of Shaul, I killed him. Kal v'chomer, I'm going to kill someone who really killed." He didn't commit murder, he didn't say, but just the one who actually killed. That implies that David felt that the boy did not kill. The boy was just a Magid. Just someone who tried to curry favor by bragging about something he didn't do. That bragging alone is enough to brag to kill the Mashiach Hashem is enough for me to feel to want to kill. Plus, I brought in forensic evidence. It's inconceivable that there was enough time for this boy to do what he said he did in between the time that Shaul fell on his sword or spear, let's give him the benefit of the doubt on one of those two, and the time that the Morim, who found him already, it says, Vimtsua Morim, right? It's inconceivable that in that short times period, 2 minutes at best, 3 minutes, that the boy could have done everything he said he did. Mm-hmm. So the evidence is there. So now, remember what I told you last week, if I want to give evidence and now I think proof that the boy was lying, at least in David's eyes, so what did he do? How did he come how did he get the crown? And he's Harry, he has the king's bracelets and crown with him. So I suggested last week, I don't know this. I can't tell this. I don't see it in any medrash or anything. But Shaul probably ditched him, the crown. He wasn't wearing them when the Philistines were chasing him. Right? There are other stories in Tanakh where a king is hiding. Remember Achav in the beginning of Malachim, when he's hiding from the Aramean battle? He removed his crown. It says he hid, he disguised himself. He's not real. When you're hiding from the Plishtim, you're not wearing your crown and bracelets. He ditched them someplace. He threw them, and the kid found them and fabricated this story to curry favor with them. That's what I said last week.
How were they able to salvage the body?
I'm sorry. What was the word?
If they were really so close to him, right? He was dying. How were the Jews able to get the bodies of Yonatan and Shaul?
So we're about to read that. But what actually happened was the Plishtim stripped them, paraded them through the streets, headless, tacked them onto the wall of their Beit Shan, right? And then some very courageous men, after that, in the middle of the night, snuck in and took the bodies back to Givat Shaul to bury in the family plot. The people who did so were the people that Shaul had helped early on with the eye. Remember that story, right?
I don't know. It's something bothers me. How did the boy get to David without someone saying there's this boy's coming with this story? In other words, you don't just get up to go move right up to the king. If you're
things are out of whack right now. The country's running. We're all in different places.
You can't. The crown, and they let him right through.
He was walking. He probably had it in the shopping bag. I don't know. I don't know. That's yes.
Is this looking back as much as a quarterback? Was it proper for him to kill the boy?
From a religious standpoint, that was really my question. Like, when is it okay?
So that's why this shiur has political undertones to it. David has to. Either because he's Amaleki, and we have a thing we have to do with Amalekim, David, by the way, has a certain aspect of Esav in him, as the red-headed one. This is a Maamar Chazal, that David acts on impulse a lot in the Sefer. The worst impulse, and interestingly enough, in Chazal, that David acts upon, of the Maran Masechet Shabbos Daf Nun Vav, that says, it's not his taking of Bathsheba, it's not with Uriah, the act of impulse that to which the Gemara says that David deserved to lose his kingdom was...
Pound the people.
Not even that. It's an amazing ethical statement of the Gemara.
Correct.
That he accepted Siva's lashon hara about Mephibosheth and said, "Split the field." And a bas kol came out and said, "Split the kingdom." That David was so impetuous about that we didn't learn this yet. If you don't know it, it seems like a minute thing. But it's that then the Daf Lamed Nun Vav in Masechet Shabbos that goes one by one, and the Gemara talks about David's various apparent misdeeds, and it clears them all away and explains them away, explains them with good drash and whatever you want to say. But at the end of that Gemara, the Gemara says, but when he accepted that lashon hara from Siva, we cannot forgive this. It's an amazing ethical statement of the Gemara that the kingdom was taken down. It's sort of like Melachim Aleph that talks about Achav's remarkable sinning with in every manner of Zara and Shvichus Domim of his wife Izebel. What takes down the kingdom? The vineyard that he took from his neighbor. The vineyard of Navot. It's amazing. We'll see this coming a lot in Tanakh. But if you want to say, let's be quarterbacks here on Monday morning and ask, did David do the right thing or not? I want a second guess. David has a kingdom to prepare for. There has been a groundswell of support for one particular tribe, for Binyamin. And now I am going to try to rest the popular mood in the nation right now to move to Yehuda, which has always been a central tribe. And let me, there's a Malbim, by the way, in Perek Hay of Shmuel Bet, where he says the reason why David moved his kingdom from Hebron to Yerushalayim was to be near Binyamin. Because Hebron is in the heart of Yehuda, Yerushalayim is right on the border with Binyamin. So by bringing the kingdom up to Yerushalayim, would make Binyamin feel part of it's like a new president coming in who accepts some of the old administration's cabinet. So let me stay close to what Binyamin is. I mean, David is a master politician, and it's crucial for him right now to not appear opportunistic in the face of the death of Shaul. Plus, he must appear sympathetic. I feel your pain. That's a very important. You know, I feel the pain of Binyamin over losing their king. It's crucial that David does not appear shows every manner of indignation and calumny towards anyone who would think he's happy with the news.
I have a feeling that when it comes to Shmichot Dagim, in regard to the king's policies, there is no censure for it, you see, in general.
I think
they are allowed. It looks like they are allowed.
Excuse me, don't you're in the wrong book. I'm sorry, you're in the wrong book. You can say what you will about what the story of David and Bathsheba's main message is. When we learn it, you will see, I hope you'll agree, that the main everlasting message of the David and Bathsheba story is, of course, repentance, to rejuvenate your relationship with God. But the main point is, how this is different than all other nations, is that after the sin, a prophet comes to David and points his finger at him and says, Atoha Ish, you are the man in this parable. And the king stands rebuked.
Right.
There's no nation in the planet Earth at that time and until relatively recently. You know, man goes over to the king of England and says, oh, please, Henry, those women that you do, what you're doing is just wrong. He's dead. You throw them out the window. So, or recently, even more recently. So one of Saddam Hussein's generals rebuked him because when women asked him to let their husbands out of jail, there were thousands of men in jail. Saddam Hussein, you know what kind of favors he'd get from them. And what general said is, does not behoove a leader of a country, an Islamic country. What are you doing with these women? He had them killed right away. And this is 10 years ago.
But so, it came from
a Chas v'shalom, I'm not using these despotic rulers as my benchmark with which to judge David HaMelech, Chas v'shalom. But I'm just saying that David does not act with impunity. He is rebuked, and he stands rebuked. And the prophet has the upper... And by the way, this will remind you back in Shmuel Aleph. Why was it that Shmuel tells Shaul, wait for me 7 days, and we'll bring a korban together, and then we'll fight the Plishtim. And Shmuel is late. It's like the Egel story. I mean, Shmuel, I assure you, purposely came late. He's testing Shaul. Will you be able to stand up to the people and say, listen, I know he's late, but we're just not starting without him. Right? It's not just that he didn't stand up to the people, but by starting to prosecute the war without the prophet, and he was successful in that battle, but by starting to prosecute the battle, you are showing that we win our battles with kings. Wrong. And you're just a sus, Shaul. We win wars with the prophet, not with the king. So this is a crucial message that the Navi, while he'll certainly honor the king, there is always a tension in Tanakh between the Navi and the Melech, between Chizkiyahu and Yeshayahu. Remember the Gemara in Shabbos, between, of course, Achav and Eliyahu, and that's what to teach you in a separate shiur on that topic, on Navi v'Hamelech. But understand that a king like David allows the Melech to... allows the Navi to have the upper hand. Simple as that. Okay, I mean, there's, you know, the bottom line is, I mean, the Gemara says explicitly in the Masechet Bava Kamma that, you know, the king eats tarfus, he gets malchus like any other Jew, you know, however you do that in private. But the point is, he's not above the law. There might have been some other kings in our history who unlawfully may put themselves above the law, but that's not what's happening here.
So according to Jewish religion, if it's legal to kill somebody like that, death sentence, then it's okay?
Okay, that's also coming out of this book. The king does have a social contract with the people to commute death penalties, as David will do in this book. Remember the story that it's a fabricated story, but David thought it was real. about a brother who killed his brother, and David said, "Nope, he deserves to die, but he will not die because I'm commuting his sentence." But the king also has, and this is actually found also after the whole discussion. This appears in the Rambam in Hilchos Melachim, the discussion of his kid. And the Rambam says, after a few explanations of why David did it, he writes at the end that it seems to me that David did it as a din in Malchus. The king has morid b'malchus. The king thinks, you have violated my space, and my reign, then I have the right to kill you.
I think what baffles us so much, because we are not used to capital punishment for every sin. There is no prison here. He had no choice to give him life sentence. There is no such thing.
Well, remember, David tells him, your blood is on your own head. You know, in other words, you've caused this to you. You brought this upon yourself. So even though we just said, what would you do given that circumstance? It's because David perceived that the boy was fabricating the story.
So that would make it less interesting. If he didn't kill, if he really believed that he killed Saul, well, yes, all right. So the person who kills a king must die. But if he believes he didn't, they actually didn't do anything. And it's just killing him for telling tales. And telling tales is usually not a capital crime. Right, right. It's not somewhere near.
Right, and there, that's why the Rambam probably concluded that David killed him as a din in Melech. The Melech feels that I look. The Rambam says better than this. If the king thinks that there's lawlessness over a certain area, that's already a Gemara in Sanhedrin. Then there's extra legal rights in the king to go beyond, you know, for to kill for rustling sheep or whatever, you know, other things like that, that in order to maintain the.
It seems like more of a society. It's such a fluid. It's open to definition. So it's essentially, if the king feels disrespected, he's allowed to kill whoever respects.
Gemara says that the reason why David killed Uriah was for two things. He told him to go home to his wife, and he didn't. And because he referred to Yoav as Va'adoni Yoav in front of the king's face. So I'm just telling you, the concept of Morid B'Malchus, we will visit when we get up to chapter 11, when David tells him to go home and he doesn't. And we'll see that in Chazal, the concept of Morid B'Malchus gets watered down as the sources get later and later. The rabbis become more enlightened, so to say, to say that Morid B'Malchus is it gives the king less and less and less power to do what he did.
Why the people who were with Uri were also killed? It made a rebellion.
Okay, all right. I have to stop this discussion. It's true. David ordered the death of Uriah together with 49, approximately. He says about 50 men died. It was a terrible thing. We'll get up to it, and we'll try to explain it as it happens. And we will come back.
Who are the other men? Besides Uriah, who are the other men?
It says that Uriah died with a number of men in the field in the battle.
Oh,
he sent him to like a suicide mission. And we'll talk about that.
So you see, they even sent Uriah away because he wanted his wife.
Anybody sent him away to die in a battle with others. Okay, I must go on. We're half hour into, and we haven't continued. But now, what I'd like you to look at is the kina that David sang after his the death of the three. It says, "Vayikonen David et hakina hazot." You see it? Starting in Perek Bet Pasuk Yud Zayin. Does it appear there at all?
Yes, not the whole thing.
Just some of it. Okay, now, I'd like to introduce you, I think I actually mentioned this word last class, the terminology is called Milat Mancha, or maybe I think we did it when we did Yonah. Milat Mancha is a terminology that appears often in a story that punctuates the story and almost defines the story. So, there seems to be a Milat Mancha in this short dirge that he sings. I only have about five or six psukim for you here, but if you have the entire text in front of you, you'll see that, first of all, the phrase, Eich Naflu Giborim. You see, Eich Naflu Giborim. He mentions it three times.
Powerful and spell.
Right? Pasuk Yetet, and Pasuk Chav Hei. And in Pasuk Chav Zayin. You don't have all of them there.
Yeah.
Naflu Giborim. Mogen Giborim. The term Gibor appears six times in this short dirge. Nisharim kalu me'arayos gaveru. The Milat Mancha would like to suggest in this story, in this kina, in this dirge, is the gibor. David laments the way Shaul went down. He went down for such a man who turned our history around from the dredges of Sefer Shoftim, and so profoundly turned our history around. Right? Think of it this way. In Sefer Shoftim, there was not one Shofet out of all 13 who fought any one battle with all 12 tribes. Mm-hmm. Every Shofet, at one point or another, either complains about that fact, right? The only one that came close to possibly fighting with everyone was told by God, send everyone home, until he ended up fighting with only 300 men, Gidon. Right? But Devorah complains, where was this tribe? That tribe was staying at home, and that tribe, where were they all coming from? The Shimshon was handed in by one of the tribes. Yiftach went to war against one of the tribes, with Ephraim, because of a perceived slight. Gidon almost went to war with Ephraim. Obviously, he didn't call them, because that means he didn't fight with everybody. So Sefer Shoftim is a sorry tale of our history of profound disunity, where if you could picture rockets are flying on Haifa from the north, and Jews in Beersheba say, that doesn't concern me, those rockets can't reach me. Or rockets reaching Beersheba from Sderot, and Jews in Haifa saying, what does that do with me? I'm living up here. But that's exactly what was going on in Sefer Shoftim. Please. And it reached its horrible, horrific crescendo at the end of the book with the terrible story where a whole tribe of Israel was almost wiped out. Shevet Binyamin, right? With the story of Pelegish Begiva, which the outrages were many, but the worst it gets is when a woman is cut up into 12 pieces, right, and sent to all the tribes of Israel to say, look what they do in this place. It's mamash like a story like Sodom. I can't say it all because it's too crazy. Right? And this woman cut up into 12 pieces is a sign of the terribly fractious nature of the nation. We have turned into 12 countries. Now, the men swore that they wouldn't give their daughters over to Shevet Binyamin, and there were just a few hundred left of them. So they regretted this. They said, what if the whole tribe in Israel is going to be wiped out? What shall we do? So they said, well, we swore we wouldn't give our daughters to Binyamin. We didn't swear we wouldn't let them take our daughters. So they had a few hundred women dancing in the fields. Right? The Gemara in Bava Basra says this took place on Tu B'Av, the end of Tainus. And that's why Tu B'Av is a day of Shadchanus. And the 300 men of Binyamin took the 300 women from the field, and they kept the tribe alive. Dancing girls in the field, and
the girls are not allowed to watch them dance.
They're single. So that's the how Sefer Shoftim ends. Now Shaul's first act as king was to unite the people in battle against the Ammonites. The Ammonites threatened the people of Yavesh Gilad. That's the city I just said where they took these 300 women from. So Yavesh Gilad is in his past, in his recent past, right? It's a question what time of Sefer Shoftim the Pelegish Begiva story took place. The end of Shoftim, beginning of Shoftim, but whatever it might be, Binyamin, anyone from Shevet Binyamin is a remnant from these women from Yavesh Gilad and the surviving men of Binyamin, right? So the Ammonites tell the people of Yavesh Gilad, which if you look at a map was pretty far from Binyamin, but they were pretty far from Ammon, but they purposely went to this city to test Shaul and to say, we'll take out your right eye as a sign of peace. If you don't take out your right eyes, we'll come and kill all of you. So the people of Yavesh Gilad appealed to Shaul. Help us, you're our new king. Save our eyes, right? And Shaul sent letters around to all the tribes and said, we're going to fight the Ammonites and save the people of Yavesh Gilad. Of course, Kedarkam, in Sefer Shoftim, none of the other tribes were interested. No one was interested but Shevet Binyamin in helping the people of Yavesh Gilad save their eyes. So what did Shaul do? He took an ox, cut it into 12 pieces, think of the end of Shoftim, sent one to each tribe and said, This is what I do to any man in that does not come in good numbers to the tribe to battle. I'll come and wipe out your animals. 360,000 people came to fight. And they routed the Ammonites and saved Yabesh Gilead. That's his first act. So you see how it's like it turns full circle, how Shaul saves the fractious nation by uniting them this way. And that's why it's the people of Yabesh Gilead who risked their lives to bring down those four bodies to take them for burial. Right? So David laments the sorry way such Giborim met their end. This is the nature of this dirge and its connection to Yabesh Gilead.
Yabesh Gilead, they're not Jewish, are they?
Like, so that's it's interesting. They're different opinions. I've been teaching this today that they're Jews. There are others who say that they weren't. That the promise was we will not give our daughters to Binyamin, but we didn't say we wouldn't give converts to Binyamin.
Oh, I see.
Right. So there's another approach to that, and both are legitimate. Okay. So this is interesting that there's a somewhat of a Milat Manchan last week's parsha, where you have the Shoresh Gimel Bet Resh to refer to the way the waters rose over the mountains. How would you say the waters covered everything? It should say Vayalu Hamayim, Vayichasu Hamayim. What's the word that Torah uses? Vayigberu Hamayim. What a strange terminology. Vayigberu Hamayim.
That's
a verb.
In Parshat Noach.
In Parshat Noach, yeah. Vayigberu Hamayim. What did the Torah call these men of renown? Giborim. Anshei Hashem. Right? I'll show you Giborim, Gvura. Right? So Shaul's main name was Mishich Mavamal Gavol Mikol Ha'am. He was Shaul HaGibor, right? And Eich Naflu Giborim, look how the end of Shaul, because he didn't do God's bidding. So this is the end of Perek Aleph. The political lesson is that David does not want to appear opportunistic. We had our moral issues with what he did to the Na'ara Maleki. David does not seem to suffer politically at all for that. I mean, no one is questioning. There's no scandal about that afterwards. I don't know if it even made the papers. So from here, I'd like to introduce what we're going to do next week. Okay, if you see, there's a calendar of classes. The first, the October was supposed to be introducing the book and doing Perek Aleph. November is for Perek Bet till Perek Dalet. And this is what I'd like to do. Is to show that there's one thing that trumps all other concerns when it comes to starting a kingdom, is the security of your people. Right? What? Today they say it's the economy. The economy means nothing if you are threatened from an enemy on the outside. The enemy is the Plishtim. And David's purpose in chapter 2 will be to secure in the minds of the people that you are safer under my kingship than under any son of Shaul's. Right? This is the test at hand. When Shaul badly needed soldiers to keep the Plishtim away from taking your cities and fighting battles against you, what was Shaul doing with 3,000 or 5,000 soldiers chasing after David, who called himself a dead fly? David is going to try to show in this chapter that your security concerns, and they are real, your security concerns over the threat from the Philistines, is better served by my rule than by the other role. And how does that manifest itself? With a really very unusual story involving a competition. I'm going to describe that competition that starts off with 12 against 12 and somehow devolved into a riot that ended up killing 380 people. It was just a bad soccer match, if you will. I don't know, but 380 people. I mean, for goodness sakes, the original battle was only 12 against 12. The Tanakh is not quite clear what the nature of the battle was, why they were fighting. It just says, "Kumu l'sachek," let's play, right? So, so in fact, remember in Parshas, this next week's Parsha, Levayera, when it says that Yishmael was mitzachek. So Rashi says that his shvichus damim, and he quotes the points to this, that he was engaging in murderous behavior from this story. Right? So the way I'm going to interpret it is very simply. It's much more than just a game of capture the flag. It was some kind of competition that they with which they were familiar, something akin to paintball, right? I'm not just saying that to be cute. Something, you know what that is, where you have to shoot ink on the other, and if you, it's not killing him, but it looks like blood.
Dueling or spears or something.
But it wasn't meant to be, it clearly was not meant to be life-threatening in any way. But it was meant to show our giborim are better than your giborim. Right? Now, David just said, Ech naflu giborim. There's no gvura anymore on their side. So I'm going to try to show that to the people. Okay? But alas, the battle, the game, whatever it is, never had a chance to get there because it quickly, as I said, devolved into a bad soccer match. Right? So, but once you understand the reason for the game, you'll see that if it didn't make sense to play it this way, but that the 380 people who perished in the wake of this tragedy that turned bloody because of the death of Asael, we'll read about next week, of the 380 people who perished, a full 360 were on Shaul's side. Mm. So David's side manifests a much greater strength and agility, or whatever you want to describe it. But 360 to 20 means that whoever's fighting on the 20 side seemed to be much more impervious to this type of death and destruction. But and therefore we're better capable of saving you from the Philistines. Right. Okay, I just want to mention a few things that lead up to this. One is that David congratulates the people of Yavesh Gilad for taking down the bodies and bringing them home. He congratulates them and suffuses them with great praise. And chizuk, why is it important for the Tanakh to tell us this?
Doing nourishative gratefulness.
Okay, that's very important for any rule to have a karasato. But in this particular case, Johnny,
have to say Shaul to show that.
She's being magnanimous. Right. He is being. I think that. Very often, a president that continuously blames every problem on the previous president is not learning this message. Just enough. At some point, you're on your own. So David wants to say that the previous administration was very bad to me. They chased me with no good cause. I did so many good things for them. I saved them from Goliath. I saved them from the Plishtim again and again. And I'm extremely magnanimous in the face of the way they behaved. And I want to show a profound yishar koach to the ones who helped Shaul and a profound, much worse than the opposite of yishar koach to the Amaleki boy who brags about harming him. So that's just an important point. I think magnanimity is such an important mida in an elected president, but it's even so in a monarch. The monarch showed that even if though I have reason to be upset I have reason to have this emotion, I'm going to be strong and powerful. I'm going to have the other emotion. It's crucial for him to publicly thank the people of Yavesh Gilad for what they did for the previous king. Shaul was a very popular king. Right? So the next point is, and this is what I'll conclude
it
with.
It was crucial to Shaul magnanimity. Right?
I'm going to give through. You'll see when I'm going to question. I give David the benefit of the doubt.
Okay.
You know, I think he gives them up. Yes, because when David is is Chazal knew when to question him. But here I give him the benefit of the doubt that he had a state dinner, he had a whole broad-based, made the papers, he made sure that the reporters were there taking pictures. And, yes.
But if he was so intent upon saving Saul and his son's bodies from the war, wouldn't he have sent himself a delegation or a special unit of soldiers to try to...
At this time, this happened already, this happened so quickly. Remember, with the death of Shaul...
They grabbed him right away. Right?
Yeah, they were just a few days or two later. David does not.
King David would have sent his own contingent of soldiers to try to rescue the bodies from the king.
But remember, maybe this is why the Tanakh reminds us of the fact that David was busy fighting a very crucial war at this time. Remember which one?
Amalek
to save the women, the families that Amalekim had just captured. This is all happening in a matter of days, and David had to bring home the women and children. Right. So it says, in fact, the story begins. David came from Ashuv Mehakosis HaMalek. Right. Okay, the last point is what appears in it's in the north of Israel.
Well, I'm saying it could be geographically, just simply where easier to get to
Beit Shean. Yeah, certainly more than Givat Shaul. It's just, I'll tell you what it is, in the northern border of Yam HaMelech. I wouldn't say how far. It's not so north, but it's on the border of Yam HaMelech. It's right off Yam HaMelech.
Which is
Yavesh Gilead. No, in the time of Tanakh, I don't know if there's a city today called Yavesh Gilead or not. But anyway, the point I'd like to conclude with is towards the middle of chapter 2, where it says that Avner ben Ner Sartzavar Shel Shaul Akachad Ishboshet ben Shaul by Avirehu Michonayim. That Avner ben Ner, who's really the power structure here, took Ishboshet. This is Perek Bet Pasuk Chet.
We don't
know. No, you don't have it on that sheet yet. So what we have to do is we have to sit with a whole Shmuel Bet in front of us. So we have a whole stack of Tanachs here, and I have a big box of Shmuel Bets. So we'll get them out now for next week. So it says that Avner crowned Ishboshet the second king of Israel. Right? And it says Ishboshet was 40 years old when he became king, and he ruled for 2 years. I ask you this question: how long did Shaul rule?
How long did Shaul rule?
Do you have an inkling?
Not too long.
Now, it never says so in Sefer Shmuel.
It doesn't say.
It never says so explicitly. There is a very cryptic pasuk, Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Aleph. Ben Shana Shaul Bimalcho Ushtayim Shanim Malach Al Yisrael. The Seder Olam accepts the fact that he ruled only 2 years. But then what does Ben Shana Shaul Bimalcho mean? The Gemara in Yuma makes a drash out of it, that he was so pure he was like a 1 year old. But what does it mean? Ben Shana. The English translations usually read Shaul was blank years. It just leaves a blank. The English here says, no, well, it was in the first year of Shaul's reign, and in parentheses, he reigned over Israel for 2 years. That's following the Seder Olam. Okay?
That's all.
So to say that Shaul's entire reign was only 2 years means that when he became king, how old was his fourth son?
38.
What? 38? And how old was Shmuel when Shmuel died? 52? Shaul was a good 20 to 25 years older than Shmuel? Who the people said, you're too old to lead us, get us a new king, and they end up hiring someone whose fourth son is 38, and who's going out to look for donkeys? Why didn't he send one of his sons?
Doesn't make sense.
Abarbanel is the one who brings all this down, and he says that in his opinion, Shaul ruled, although he has no proof of this, he just says that if David was 30 when David became king, and he seems to be a little lad in this story, so he thinks that Shaul was ruled for about 17 to 20 years. That's what he thinks. Right? So then, things can work out a little better. Mm-hmm. But to say he only ruled 2 years is a diminution of a lot of time here. Just considering the fact that his son is 40, when he was his fourth son, he had three older sons. This is the fourth one listed. Maybe he's the oldest and he's just listed fourth, but still, even if he's the oldest son. Anyway, that's not my point here. My point here is to wonder why Avner, who's a seasoned general, an important person in Israel, would make such a foolish choice of Ishbosheth, who we're going to see is so not groomed and not worthy of being a king. And you choose him over David.
Who's lame, right?
No, that was his nephew. Of the same name.
Because he was the son of Shaul, and Avner had no way of staying general.
Right. He's my way of staying in power. We keep the same administration, basically. He'll keep me in my position. If David becomes king, he's not going to have me as his advisor, or as his chief of staff. So that's one thing. Two, he just wants to be loyal to his family. Remember, he's related to Shaul. Also, he's Shaul's cousin. Three, I think I mentioned this last week, that there was a prophecy that two kings have to emerge and emanate from Binyamin. Melachim Echalotzach Yetzev, and he was fulfilling that prophecy. Okay, then let's accept that. So Avner appoints him as king. They have this battle. Shaul's side is wiped out in this battle. So Avner is not in a great position. And somehow Ishbosheth does something very foolish in chapter 3. And I have to assume that it was true. Listen to what I'm about to tell you. And it must be true. So if it wasn't true, it makes no sense for the king to even if it's true, it makes no sense that the king accused him. The king, Ishbosheth, accused Avner of taking Ritzpah bat Aya. Who is she? Ritzpah bat Aya, who, by the way, will show up again in the end of Shmuel Bet. Ritzpah bat Aya was a Pilegesh of Shaul. She's not called the wife of Shaul, but she's called the Pilegesh of Shaul. All right, let's however you want to see it. Taking any former wife of, we'll see, even less than Pilegesh, of a king is tantamount to taking the kingdom. Whether it's true in Hamlet, it's true in Macbeth, it's true even, think of the beginning of Melachim Aleph, where after Adoniyahu gave up his desire for the throne over Shlomo, but then a few years into the reign, he asked Bathsheba to ask Shlomo for the hand of Avishag HaShunamit. That's all I ask for. Let him be the king, let him have his 1,000 wives, let him have the kingdom, build a base of Mikdash and everything that comes with it. All I want is Avishag HaShunamit. Now, who's Avishag HaShunamit? The young lady in the Haftorah of Parshas Chayesara that keeps David warm. And it says he didn't know her. She just kept him excited, whatever. But after Shlomo got wind of the fact that Adoniyahu wanted Avishag HaShunamit, he said, and maybe he wants the kingdom too? Right? He saw this treasonous. And he killed him for it. He killed his brother for this. So when Avner is accused of taking a former Pilegesh of the king, we know what that means. And Avner, and that's why I say it must have been true, because if it wasn't true, it's insane for him. I think it's insane for him to accuse him even if it was true. Because Avner is his whole power. Without Avner, he wouldn't be king, and Avner knows it, and he knows it. So why accuse Avner? We'll never know. But Avner's reaction was not kind. Avner says, I don't need your accusations. If I want to become king of the northern tribes, I don't need to take Ritzpah bas Aya to prove that I'm king. I could have crowned myself king instead of you. I crowned you out of loyalty to your father. I don't need your accusations. I am going over to David's side. Been impetuous himself. I'm going to teach you a lesson. Don't you ever accuse me again. He may have accused him a number of times. And he said, I've had enough already. I can't take this anymore. And he tries to make a pact with David. Of course, that's not seen as good news for Yoav for three reasons. I hate him. He killed my brother. Now, I didn't say that. Remember, I told you just I hinted at the fact that the game turned a little bloody in the middle, right? Mm-hmm. That's because Avner killed Yoav's younger brother, Asael.
Where did you do that? Just what did you do?
It was part of the game, but look, that's with our analysis.
Oh, running.
Right. So he killed my brother. Right. He's going to take my place because Avner is certainly a better general than Yoav. Yoav is a young kid. He's a seasoned general for a number of years of a proven army. And three is that I think he's a traitor. He's treasonous for appointing Ishbosheth as king instead of you. Right? By the way, in chapter 5...
Why
didn't Ishbosheth kill Avner?
The same way as he killed this...
Hold on. Why didn't who kill Avner?
David.
At what point?
Avner wanted to betray the king. The king.
Why didn't he kill Avner when? At what point? When he crowned Ishbosheth king?
When he decided was good.
In other words, he's saying when Avner came over to David's side, why didn't David just kill him at that point?
Yeah. No, because he sees this as an advantage. Because that's not David. That would be a politically stupid thing for him to do.
Of course.
He's not just coming by himself. He's got a whole army with him.
Plus, there's another thing. Hold it. If an Iranian tomorrow would land a sophisticated plane in Israel and say, I want to give this plane that the Russians just sold us to Israel. I hate Iran. I want to give you every secret Iran has. I love the Jews. I've been trying to get out of Iran for many years. What's the first thing Israel is going to want to do with that guy? They're going to want to ask him a couple of questions and explain him to do, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what David does. And David has a test. He has a brilliant test. And this we really have. We'll leave. David has a brilliant test. It's such an amazing test. Bring me my wife.
Why?
Because Ishbosheth is Michal's brother. And Ishbosheth isn't going to want Michal delivered to the king to unify the kingdom. If you, Avner, can deliver my wife, and it's even without all the politics, she's my wife, right? We'll explain next week why she hasn't been living with David all this time. But if you can deliver my wife, then not only do I get my wife back, but I can see that you have the power to act in defiance of Ishbosheth. Uh-huh. That you really are. It's sort of like when the drug dealers want to make sure that this guy is not really a police officer. What they're going to do is they'll have him kill. Let's see if I can get the comparison. So here I want you to see how much you're really on my side. Can you deliver the goods?
She was married already.
And he does.
She was married already.
But the Gemara says she never touched him. Ishbosheth, Palti ben Laish. You know that whole thing that
she never.
Right. They behaved like bachurim. Niet cherev beino leveino v'omar kol shetoim. He put a sword between them. It's called Palti El ben Laish Palat.
Ishbosheth himself went to David at the end.
Yes, indeed. Because he saw that if he doesn't, he's dead very soon. and he was right. He went. He was still dead very soon.
Was this like a civil war going on, or was it mostly in the court? Among the court people.
When a new kingdom comes on, the old kingdom is not going to give it up so easily. Okay, so more politics next week. We're going to start with Perek Bet. If you have a Shmuel Bet at home, please bring it.